And so now what NATO has been doing is trying to deliver on that spending, not only just trying to increase its defense spending, but trying to turn that defense spending into actual capabilities. You know, some leaders have risked their political futures to push forward on higher defense spending. European allies over the last couple of days highlighted a $300 billion order backlog for U.S. defense equipment. NATO 3.0 is a more Europeanized NATO.
Hey, welcome back to the MWI podcast, brought to you with the generous support of the West Point class of 1974. I'm John Amble, and on this episode, we're taking a look at the NATO summit that just took place in Turkey. The leaders of the alliance's 32 member states spent 2 days together in Ankara. So what can we discern from the event about the state of the alliance? NATO unity has been challenged in recent years, but are there new divisions or are those fissures closing? What about the defense spending increases that members have committed to? Are they hitting those goals? And more importantly, what impact does more spending have on the alliance's actual defense capabilities? To explore those questions and more, I'm joined today by Rachel Rizzo. She is a senior fellow with the Observer Research Foundation's Strategic Studies Program. In that role, as well as her previous work with the Atlantic Council and the Center for New American Security, she has focused on U.S. foreign policy, transatlantic relations, and NATO. In the discussion you're about to hear, she shares her insights on the biggest takeaways from the recent summit and the state of the alliance today. Before we get to it, as always, a couple quick notes. First, a very special thank you to the West Point class of 1974 for their generous support to MWI. And second, what you hear in this episode are the views of the participants and don't represent those of West Point, the Army, or any other agency of the U.S. government. All right, here's my conversation with Rachel Rizzo. Rachel, welcome to the MWI podcast.
Thank you for having me.
So I invited you on. We obviously just wrapped up the Ankara summit, NATO summit. I asked you to come on because I had read something that was really interesting that you wrote, you and a co-author, in anticipation of the summit, things to kind of look out for. And I thought it would be really interesting after the summit to have you on the podcast and kind of maybe do a bit of an autopsy on the summit and use it as kind of an inflection point to assess kind of the state of the alliance right now in the middle of 2026. Before we get started, I wonder if you could just kind of briefly introduce yourself to listeners.
Yeah, absolutely. So Rachel Rizzo, I'm a senior fellow in the Strategic Studies Program at the Observer Research Foundation, which is a think tank based in New Delhi. And I've looked at European security from a U.S. lens. I looked at NATO from a U.S. lens for a very long time. And I'm spending some time in India now, sort of looking at Europe from an Indo-Pacific and India lens. So kind of a switch, but still looking at Europe, as always.
Before we get started, I'm curious about that. How different is that lens?
I mean, it's pretty different in that, you know, I think that Europe has always looked at the United States as its primary partner, its primary ally in terms of security, in terms of defense, in terms of, you know, economics and trade. But I think with the last, you know, 4 to 8 years in the United States, just the sort of political ups and downs, Europe has really started looking for new partners in the world. And that is proven by the recent free trade agreement that was signed with India, as well as the security and defense partnership that was signed between the EU and India to sort of offer a framework for defense cooperation. And so you sort of see Europe looking to other places in the world for new and deeper partnerships, and India is certainly a central part of that strategy.
I swear we are going to get onto the summit, but I am kind of fascinated by this. You know, from an Indian perspective, then, when we're specifically talking about defense and security relationships, is the EU the dominant partner, or is there, you know, a space for NATO to sort of engage with India?
I mean, I think it depends on how you look at it. I wouldn't say that India's primary lens through which they view its relationship with Europe is NATO. Not at all, actually. It's certainly the European Union. But through that, obviously, there are bilateral relationships that are the most important to India, you know, namely Germany, France, Spain, Italy, the UK, but also, I mean, its relationship with the United States is still central to Indian foreign policy, especially in terms of, as I've mentioned before, you know, trade, security, and defense. But India is definitely looking at, you know, moving up the global value chain. I think it's the, you know, fourth largest economy in the world right now. That is growing. It's growing quickly. It's looking to develop its defense industrial base through real partnerships, through things like IP sharing. And so you see India asserting itself in a way I think that it hasn't before in the past. And I think it's because it knows that blocs like the European Union, countries in Europe, need new partners, and India is there ready to be that for them.
So let's shift gears then and talk about the Ankara summit. I mentioned to you before we started recording that, you know, there are some, I mean, these are regular occurrences, right? But there are some summits that, you know, Madrid, that something feels big about them because there's a big announcement or there's some big agreement reached. And then there are others that kind of, you know, not to trivialize them because they're still important, but become sort of footnotes in NATO's history. Where does this, the Ankara summit, fall in that spectrum, do you think?
Look, I think, you know, if I'm going to put a just sort of crude point on it, it's probably going to be one of the more forgettable summits. And the reason I say that is because of a couple things. You know, first, the really memorable summit, it was the 75th anniversary back in 2024, and that was when Biden was still in office and all of the NATO allies, heads of government, came to Washington, D.C. and did basically this victory lap, highlighting the strength of NATO, highlighting the unity of NATO. You know, this was just 2.5 years after Russia's full-scale invasion in Ukraine. There had been a lot of back and forth about Europeans leading the defense of Ukraine, you know, offering them weapons, selling them weapons, the role of the U.S., and I think leaders like Putin had taken stock of those factures and divisions, and they really wanted to put on a unifying front. And then you had last year's summit, 2025, in The Hague. Trump is obviously back in office at that point. The allies agree to not only spend the agreed upon 2% of GDP on defense, something that was reinforced at the Wales summit in 2014, but they now agree that they're going to spend 5% of their GDP on defense. 3.5% of that is going to be on hard defense issues. The last 1.5% is going to be on supporting things like infrastructure, cyber, those types of things. And so now what NATO has been doing is trying to deliver on that spending, not only just trying to increase its defense spending, but trying to turn that defense spending into actual capabilities, which at the end of the day really is what matters. You talk about how much you're spending on defense, but if it's not going to actual capabilities to defend the European continent, then what does it actually matter? So I think that's what the Ankara summit was about. It was about delivering on that defense spending and at the same time showing Trump that Europeans are stepping up to the plate. I think one thing we saw at this summit was less fear and less commotion from European allies as a result of what Trump has to say, because they are now used to him coming to these summits and, you know, being bombastic and sitting on stage and saying certain things. And there's always been a pretty intense reaction from Europeans on that front. But I think we're seeing now, because they are backing up their words with actual actions, the outcomes of these summits, certainly this summit specifically, is healthier than it has been in the past.
So what are those outcomes? You know, looking back in the summit, what are the most important, I guess, things that were accomplished over the course of these 2 days in Ankara?
Yeah, I mean, I think that when you look at, say, a country like Ukraine, who is obviously not a member of NATO, but certainly relies on support from NATO members for its defense, Donald Trump appeared to give Zelensky, Ukraine's president, the nod of approval for Ukraine strikes against, you know, Russian oil facilities and other targets that are, you know, bringing war to Moscow's front door. He gave Ukraine permission to build Patriot air defense systems. That's a really big deal. He said Trump said he would move ahead with the sale of F-35 fighter jets to Turkey. America had blocked this sale in 2020 after Turkey purchased an S-400 air defense system from Russia. Now, of course, Congress says that America can provide Turkey with the F-35s only when they no longer possess the Russian air defense battery. So that's something to take note of. But you also had things like, you know, NATO Secretary General Mark Rutte announcing a joint procurement of Saab's Global Eye aircraft to modernize airborne early warning systems. You have allies jointly acquiring U.S.-made Northrop Grumman, the MQ-4C Triton uncrewed aircraft for maritime surveillance. You have strategic airlift expansion, U.S. missile procurement, submarine procurement. So you have all of these really hard targets that NATO allies are starting to make, and they're coming to the summit with receipts, with proof of them. I think European allies over the last couple of days highlighted a $300 billion order backlog for U.S. defense equipment. And this proves, I think, the defense spending boom really directly supports not only American jobs, but the American defense industry as well. So Mark Rutte is all about keeping NATO unity. And part of keeping NATO unity right now is keeping Donald Trump happy. And I think that they did that over the last few days.
And is the best way of maintaining that unity in under the current sort of strategic and political context, is the best way defense spending, essentially?
Yes, I absolutely think so. And like I said before, defense spending, sure, but the most important thing is making sure that defense spending translates into increased and more efficient defense capabilities on the European continent. You know, we've had a strategic posture review in the Pentagon where the United States is sort of looking at its troop presence in Europe. It has drawn down a few thousand troops from Germany. It has said it's not going to re-up a rotational force of 4,000 troops in Poland. And obviously, this has sort of sent Europeans into a frenzy, because any conversation about the U.S. decreasing troop presence in Europe causes a panic almost reflexively. It's always been like that. But I've always been in the camp that a stronger Europe means a more committed United States. And I've always said that European nations are wealthy. They have the defense spending capabilities. They have the technology. They have the ability to really step up to the plate, and they should be doing that. And so I think that for this administration, you know, translating those capabilities or translating that spending into real defense capabilities won't, as some people might suggest, create a scenario where the United States draws down more. I think the opposite is actually true, where a more capable, united, efficient European defense market will create a scenario where the United States is actually more committed. This administration, Donald Trump specifically, he likes winners. He likes strength. And so this is good for Europe. And I've always said that.
You mentioned defense capabilities, you mentioned political unity. These are two very important factors, but they're two factors among many that sort of combine to, I guess, kind of give us a sense of the health, if we can say that, of the alliance. If we were able to track that coming out of this summit, is it fair to say that, you know, that is trending upward? Is it perhaps neutral?
Look, I think that it's, you know, maybe neutral to trending upward. And the reason I say that is because, you know, I remember the first NATO summit when Donald Trump was president in 2018. You know, he came to, this was in Brussels. Was it 2016 or 2018? Anyways, it was his first NATO summit in Brussels, and, you know, really came to the North Atlantic Council and, railed against allies for, you know, burden sharing, for freeloading. Remember, this is not the first administration to do that. U.S. presidents going all the way back to Dwight Eisenhower have warned against too much European reliance on United States defense. And so I think there was a panic amongst Europeans then, but it was a panic because they didn't really know what to expect. They didn't really know where the relationship was going to go. And since then, I mean, if you've been sort of watching the U.S. relationship with NATO between Trump, between Biden, it has gone up and down. You know, Biden came back into office and said that the United States is back. The Europeans breathed a sigh of relief. But they have always behind the scenes, I think, understood that the underlying foundation of the U.S.-European relationship, where the U.S. is the ultimate guarantor of Europe's security, can no longer hold, no matter who is in the White House. It's just, it's been that way since the end of World War II, and Europe understands that it really has to stand up, step up to the plate in a pretty profound way. And I do think that the Trump administration does deserve credit for this. They deserve credit for pushing Europe in this direction and for getting them to spend more and really put money where their mouth is. And so I think for a summit like this, you know, you have the United States come in and everyone is sort of nervous about making sure that they walk away happy. But I think that Europe has taken the steps necessary in order to make sure that that relationship holds, in order to make sure that the United States remains committed. And so in that sense, I think the relationship is on the upswing. Obviously, it makes Europeans very nervous when they hear, you know, threats about taking Greenland or needing to own Greenland and control that autonomous Danish territory. But at this point, I think they're pretty used to it. And so they're able to take comments like that in stride and look at the broader picture. And I think that's really important.
You know, I just pulled up at every one of these summits, you know, they always do this sort of official photo where all of the heads of government are kind of arrayed on a dais across, you know, three steps.
Yeah, family photo.
Yeah, exactly. NATO has been for more than three quarters of a century a remarkably enduring sort of unified alliance through some very difficult times, through a lot of changes. It has endured. But you look at this and you're struck also by, you know, how much diversity, I guess, there is. And I said, you've got the Finnish president and the Swedish prime minister representing the two newest NATO member states. You've got front and center as the host, Erdogan, the Turkish president. Turkey has been at various times, sometimes kind of a challenging member state of the alliance, but also a geostrategically essential one.
Sure.
You know, Hungary under Viktor Orban was probably one of the largest challenges for other NATO member states to navigate. You've now got Peter Magyar, the leader of Hungary who defeated Orban in the elections about a month or two ago. When you look at this, at the family photo, when you look at it, I guess, you know, through that lens, where are your eyes drawn? What stories are you sort of, you know, are coming to mind for you?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, this is the thing about NATO. It is a consensus-based organization, and it has also expanded through the years. It's 32 members now, and no major decision can be made at the North Atlantic Council without total consensus from every member. So that means what ends up happening is you end up in these really deep in the weeds negotiations, and you also end up having to sort of set aside some of the bilateral issues that might be affecting NATO members. But when I look at the family photo, and when I think about countries that are really going to sort of set the stage for, as Secretary General Mark Rutte puts it, NATO 3.0. You know, I look at a country like Germany, where Germany has really, really struggled over the past, you know, decades, actually, to increase its defense spending because of a, you know, population passivity that has run through German society since World War II, and a real aversion to militarization and aversion to defense spending. But also, you know, it is the industrial heart of Europe. And when Europe's industry depends now on revving up defense spending, it also depends on a country like Germany being able to shift its economy to a way that supports that move for Europe. And it's created a scenario where Germany has really had to face an internal reckoning about the role that it plays, not just in the world, but specifically in Europe and NATO as well. So I think that's one. know, I would also look at a country like the United Kingdom, which is no longer part of the European Union, but is still a key member of the NATO defense community. I would look at Italy as well. You know, when Giorgia Meloni was elected a few years ago, there was a real fear that her anti-Europe sort of populist rhetoric would create a scenario where Italy became sort of the new Hungary in NATO, where allies had to sort of work around Italy's internal politics to make major decisions. But, you know, Giorgia Meloni has been incredibly pro-Ukraine and incredibly pro-NATO and pro-Europe. And I think that's, you know, been a welcome result for NATO allies. You know, certainly Turkey has been difficult. It's sort of a can't live with them, can't live without them situation. But again, that's why NATO has succeeded and survived for the last 77 years at this point, because it has to work around these, you know, bilateral and domestic issues and come to a consensus based on what is in the interest of the North Atlantic region and what is in the interest of the defense of Europe ultimately. And this is in the broad interest of each of these countries bilaterally. And so I think the success of these, you know, major negotiations, major decisions really show that unity is possible even in the face of decisions that may not be agreed upon by the entire alliance.
You mentioned the Secretary General's, what he called NATO 3.0. Can you describe that a little bit?
Yeah, I mean, NATO 3.0 is a more Europeanized NATO. It is a NATO whereby the European pillar of the alliance takes more of the onus for Europe's continental defense. As I mentioned, the, you know, underlying agreement between Europe and the United States has always been that the buck rests with America, that, you know, Europe has troops, it has defense capabilities, but really at the end of the day, Europe cannot defend itself without the United States. And that remains true to this day. But I think Mark Rutte as Secretary General, certainly Jens Stoltenberg, former Secretary General, have understood that for NATO to survive and remain strong, the onus of European defense must rest on the shoulders of Europeans. And so I think NATO 3.0 is really about, as I've used this phrase before, putting their money where their mouth is, putting their money behind actual defense capabilities that will result in a scenario where they can defend themselves and where the ultimate defense doesn't necessarily rely on Europe or on the United States. Obviously, the U.S. will remain a key ally, will remain a key part of this. But the era, I think, where America was really seen as the de facto leader of NATO is really over. And I think that that has created a lot of anxiety, especially in the United States. But I think that is the way forward if NATO is to survive. And it's good that, you know, we have a Secretary General that realizes that and is able to push NATO allies in that direction.
You know, I think coming off of on the back of a summit like this, there's a tendency, and we're doing it right now, right? To look at the summit and ask how much unity we're seeing, you know, are there divisions that we're seeing? And, you know, this summit, that the family photo, those 32 heads of government representing 32 member states, that is NATO. NATO is also a number of commands, offices where people get up every day and go to work and do the work of the alliance. How much is sort of that operational side of NATO insulated from the ups and downs and maybe less predictable trajectory of some of the political dynamics surrounding the alliance?
Yeah, I mean, I think momentum is a powerful tool, and the momentum behind NATO has built and grown since 1949. And I think this is the case for any sort of, you know, government entity, be it bilateral, be it multilateral, be it local, national. The way that things actually get done really comes down to the men and women who get up in the morning and go sit at their desk every day and work with one another. And I think NATO is no different. You know, when you actually look at the inner workings of NATO, it's about, you know, diplomats from 32 countries, you know, sitting together at NATO HQ in Brussels and pushing things forward. You know, it's about, like you said, various headquarters and the military leaders there, some of which the U.S. has tried to transition to European leaders, you know, military roles in NATO that have traditionally been held by Americans. They've tried to push those to Europe, which I think is probably a good move if we really want NATO to evolve in a way where Europe takes a broader share of the responsibility. But I think this is why an alliance like NATO, it hasn't been insulated from political ups and downs, but it survives because of this. And even if you look at high-level statements from U.S. leaders, you know, U.S. Permanent Representative to NATO Matthew Whitaker, Secretary of State Marco Rubio, they have all stood by U.S. membership in NATO. They've stood by America's support of NATO's Article 5, the Collective Defense Clause. And so even if there are, you know, bombastic statements made from the top, the people who really make those decisions at the end of the day and who really push them forward have reiterated many times that the United States is committed. And I think that for, as I've mentioned before, any, you know, multilateral organization, that's where the decisions are really made and that's where the momentum really is. And that matters for NATO. And it's why it is still successful today.
If defense spending and turning that defense spending into real defense capabilities is, as you mentioned, the most appropriate lens through which to view this summit. And European leaders were able to effectively, as you mentioned, bring the receipts to show that they are making progress on those fronts. Is there consensus amongst NATO watchers, NATO observers, that this summit was a success?
I don't necessarily think that, you know, there's differences of opinion in the outcome. I think the general consensus is, look, NATO summits have always been rocky when the United States is making decisions that Europeans might not agree with. But I think the general consensus is that Europeans now know how to deal with this much better than they have in the past. Mark Rutte has done a really good job, even though, you know, some people look at Mark Rutte and, you know, he was doing a press conference at this NATO summit. And there was a Scandinavian journalist who asked him about the way he deals with the United States and if it affects his sense of self-respect, because he's always just falling over himself trying to prove NATO's worth to the United States. And, you know, I think that's his job, really, is to keep unity and to keep NATO together. And I think he's done a really good job with it, even though at sometimes it's sort of a cartoonish representation of NATO and of the alliance. But I think I wouldn't walk away from this summit and say, wow, A+, this is great. I would say it's one of those summits that you have to do. You shake hands, you take the family photo, you highlight what Europe has done, what steps it has made. Europe sort of like takes the slap on the wrist that they know that they're going to get from the US, and everyone walks away. In that sense, I think it's fine. I do think NATO really needs to think hard about whether or not it wants to keep doing summits every year. And yeah, this is the thing. Like, it didn't used to do summits every year. I don't know why it puts itself through this. It's sort of torture where, you know, the entire outcome of the summit is sort of based on how the United States decides to show up and decides to, you know, interact with NATO. And the entire point is sort of highlighting its relevance and highlighting what Europe has done. If it's just going to become a show like that, I think that it really needs to think hard about whether or not doing this yearly is really in service of the ultimate goals of the NATO alliance. And at this point, I think it's more of a torture than it is a success, or it is a meeting that really matters to people and to allied leaders. And so if I were NATO leadership, I'd really think hard about how they want to do these summits going forward and whether or not they're worth it every year. They probably aren't.
But is there a flip side to that? Because it's one thing to commit to spending X number of dollars or some percentage of your GDP on defense issues. It's another to have to show up as sort of an accountability exercise and prove, you know, show your work, so to speak. Is that the argument in favor of doing them every year, particularly in an environment like this where there's a lot of pressure on European capitals to boost that spending?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, this was, like I said, for the Ankara summit, this was an opportunity for Europeans to come to the table with receipts and say, look, look, look what we've done. Look how great we're doing. And for the US to clap and say, oh, great, you're doing a good job. You've done exactly what you've asked us to do, and we can take credit for it. And then everyone shakes hands and walks away. If that's what we're looking for, then that's fine. I think you can do that without summitry and without the pomp and circumstance that comes along with summitry. What I would also say is that I think summits like this, they bring a lot of attention to NATO, which can be good on one side. They bring a lot of attention also, though, to the fact that NATO allies, European allies in NATO, are really pushing hard on their defense budgets. And that is a domestically difficult issue for some leaders. Yeah. You know, some leaders have risked their political futures to push forward on higher defense spending at the expense of social programs that are very popular to Europeans, at the expense of their own political popularity at home. And so I think in that sense, that also feeds into this question about whether it's worth it to really push forward and highlight defense, defense, defense every year when the home front for some people is a much more politically sensitive place for them. And these are much more politically sensitive decisions that European leaders have to make. And sometimes it's easier for leaders to make these decisions quietly rather than having to show up and highlight them and publicize them in such a public way for everyone to see. And so I think that, you know, falls into these questions as well about how we really want to highlight these and how you want to do summits going forward.
If we, you started by saying that, you know, this summit was a success for Volodymyr Zelensky in Ukraine. How does this look from Moscow?
Well, I mean, you never really know how the relationship between the U.S. and Russia is going to play out. I think there's a recency bias with the U.S. president, and I think that's normal for most leaders. You know, when he speaks to Zelensky and you see Zelensky and Ukraine winning, that makes the United States more apt to support it because it wants to hitch its wagon to a winner. But you never know how the next conversation might go between Putin and Donald Trump and how that might swing the U.S. or Trump in that direction. And so I think, you know, Putin probably hates to see NATO unity. It probably hates to see increased defense spending that goes towards not just European continental defense, but also goes towards Ukraine at all. It probably wants to see the United States slap Ukraine on the wrist for targeting oil facilities and other targets inside of Russia and in and near Moscow. That's not coming from the United States. So I don't think that Putin would look at this summit as, you know, the major unifying summit since the full-scale invasion. But I think he would look at it as evidence of European capabilities becoming increased, more efficient. He would look at it as a summit that I think does highlight that there's still continued NATO unity against Putin, against Moscow, even if there are bilateral issues. And his ultimate goal is to create the fractures and fissions in the NATO alliance that ultimately weaken it. And NATO knows that. And it is, and that's why it wants to go to these summits and present a united front, is for leaders like Putin to see that.
Is there anything that other sort of external observers, Beijing, you know, how does this summit look like from their perspective, or from the perspective of major non-NATO allies like Australia, for instance?
You know, I think that the way that outside, not necessarily partners, I mean, Australia is certainly a partner, and NATO has increased its engagement with the Indo-Pacific region. And I think that that is how a country like China looks at these NATO summits. You know, it was just a few years ago that NATO finally included China in its strategic concept and in its communiques, mm-hmm. You know, talking about how it is a strategic challenge to the European continent. And in many ways, there are a lot of people in think tanks and policymaking circles that want to see NATO become much more deeply engaged in the Indo-Pacific, even going so far as to having a, you know, a liaison office in Japan, which, you know, France was against, and, you know, they ultimately put the kibosh on that. But you see NATO looking at the Indo-Pacific, looking at countries like Japan, Korea, Australia, as real partners in its activities or in the way it approaches the Indo-Pacific. And so China definitely has an interest in keeping an eye on that. I don't see a scenario where NATO, you know, where NATO's AOR, you know, really goes beyond Europe, and you really see NATO activities in the Indo-Pacific region. There are some people that want that. I don't think that that's what NATO's, the point of NATO is, and I don't think that that's where NATO is going to go. But certainly China is looking at those decisions and looking at those conversations and deciding how it should respond.
Anything else from the summit that we haven't touched on that you think is worth taking note of?
I mean, not really. I think the one thing I would say is that I think that there is always... there's been a difficulty amongst European leaders on where Europe needs to go from here. I think that there's been a fear amongst some countries, you know, look at Poland, for instance, that's on the front lines of Europe's or Ukraine's war against Russia. It has always been fearful that a more capable Europe, more in defense spending, a more efficient defense industrial base will result in a scenario where the United States decides that it can disengage. And because of that, you've had disagreements amongst European leaders about how much NATO should actually Europeanize. What I would say is that I think that there is broad agreement now amongst European allies that that does need to happen, and that that is a good thing for NATO, and that that is a way to keep the United States committed and engaged, no matter who is in the White House. And I think what we also have seen from this NATO summit is, you know, up until now, European allies have just said, look, we're spending. And now what they're trying to do is say, look, this is exactly what we are spending on. This is where our money is going. These are the capabilities that we are actually developing. This is why this is good for Europe and NATO and the United States ultimately. And so I think we're seeing a much more nuanced conversation about European capabilities, about the Europeanization of NATO, where that also highlights that there's a unifying vision behind NATO and behind where it has to go. And I think that will ensure its strength, not just today, but going forward.
You raised the very reasonable question about whether or not doing these summits annually really serves much of a purpose. For the time being, that is the plan. The next one in 2027, I believe, is in Albania.
Yeah.
Will defense spending and defense capability be the framework once again that we should kind of look at that summit through? Or, you know, kind of a related question is, what does a successful year for NATO look like between now and the next summit?
Yeah, I think that for the foreseeable future, especially until, you know, 2028, when we have another U.S. election, that's going to be the framework through which NATO's European allies view themselves, is defense spending, defense capabilities, and what is actually resulting from increased defense spending. So I would expect for the summit in Albania next year to have a very similar framework for this one. But, you know, you're also going to a summit in the Balkans. And so there might be a question about, you know, what does NATO enlargement look like? Is NATO enlargement possible? Should NATO enlargement happen? I mean, this is a conversation that has been going on for decades at this point, especially when it comes to a country like Ukraine. Georgia used to be on this list as well. It's no longer anymore. But I think there are major conversations that have been sort of set to the side, but they're not necessarily buried, but they're less important than they are now, because defense spending has taken center stage. But depending on where the summit is, you know, some of those conversations start to become more important, and they become a reminder of all of the issues NATO has to deal with. I think between now and next year, a successful year for NATO, in my opinion, would be increased Europeanization of the alliance. So the Europe being able to come to the table yet again and saying, here's where we were last year in terms of spending, in terms of, you know, the relationship with the European Union, for example. And here's how this ultimately strengthens NATO. And I think that's obviously what we're going to see.
Well, Rachel, I think we will leave it there. Look, I'm personally a big believer that U.S. membership in NATO is a good thing for our national security, our national defense. But even for people who are more skeptical about that, it is a fact of life. It is an important part of our sort of strategic defense enterprise, our membership in NATO. And so these summits, you know, even if they are sort of pageantry and pomp, they're important. And so we appreciate you. I appreciate you coming on and sharing some of your insights into this one. We'll have to have you on again in a year after the Albania summit.
Yeah, absolutely. We'll have a conversation again.
Thanks, Rachel.
Thanks.
Hey, thank you so much for listening to the MWI podcast. One last thing. If you aren't following MWI on social media, you can find us on Twitter/X, Facebook, or LinkedIn. It is a great way to stay up to date on all of the new articles, podcast episodes, research, and more that we're publishing every day. Thanks again.